Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the show where we get smart together about all things tech, economics, and culture.
We have experts on the program from time to time. Sometimes those experts are, we do. Sometimes it's all y'all, because as we say, none of us is as smart as all of us.
Yes, today we are all joining forces to talk about this topic. You may have heard the occasional headline about No Not Trade. Can I just, I'm going to have a side note here and say, yes. I took a screenshot today of my podcast feed, which was just literally four podcasts in a row, all of whose headlines were about trade. And I was like, perhaps I need some diversity. Today, we are bringing you that diversity. We're talking about climate change. But don't, it's like, it's going to be, just don't. It's not going to be doom and gloom. It's not going to be all dark place. Wow. However, we are starting with a little bit of dark place. The UN published this climate report recently that says that as many, obviously, as a million, obviously, they published it because everybody was talking about it, that says as many as a million plant and animal species risk extinction, severe wildlife decline, loss of biodiversity in ecosystems, and obviously, it's expected to get worse as climate change continues.
Also, it will kill us all.
Yes.
So I just thought I'd throw that out there. I don't want to be really doomy and gloomy, but that's really what's at stake here. So that's why we're going to sort of talk about a lot of things that are going on and how we might approach this. And we're doing this, Molly Wood, because?
Well, we're doing it, yeah, because I got tired of the, I am a solutions-oriented lady, as you may have discerned from listening to this podcast, and thought to myself, actually, I had this great encounter with a climate scientist who essentially said, she was one of the signatories on all those UN reports. She was a, you know, co-recipient of the Nobel Prize with for the science behind Inconvenient Truth. And she said, look, we're to the point now where we've passed this tipping point, and the only way forward in a lot of ways is engineering. And I said, great, that makes this my story. So we started this because now it's a bit of a tech story, and there's this conversation about adaptation and the role that technology can play in literally helping us survive. And so we launched this new series called How We Survive. It's ongoing this week, and then we'll have stories every 2 weeks, and we're going to be talking about the role of technology in helping us adapt to and survive climate change, which, you know, meant great opportunity for like a crossover.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is talk to somebody who actually knows his stuff on this one. Solomon Tsiang is a professor of public policy at Berkeley. He's on sabbatical. He's a visiting scholar at Stanford at their Center of Global Poverty and Development. We got him on the phone, and we're gonna put him through his paces here. Solomon, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Can we do a very quick definition? Yeah, right. Don't panic. It won't really be through your paces. Can we talk for a second, just to set terms of this debate, mitigation versus adaptation, so we all know what we're talking about?
Yeah. So when we think about what we should do about climate change, there's been a lot of policy discussions about these two options you talk about. Mitigation is the idea that we should reduce our emissions today to avoid having dramatic climate changes in the future. Adaptation is this idea that when we arrive in the future and the climate has changed, we'll come up with technologies or different types of solutions that will help us cope with those changes. And so from a policy standpoint, you want to think about both of those tools. Those are both sort of actions that society can take. One is today, one is tomorrow. And there's a lot of debate about which one's more cost effective, which one is the better investment, right? Because if we're going to use resources for one of them, or maybe both of them, we want to do it in the way that gets us sort of the most bang for the least amount of buck.
And it's a bit of a controversy now, right? Because adaptation is becoming sort of a bigger part of the conversation lately as the effects of climate change really start to be felt.
I think it certainly is a controversy in some circles. Historically, I think there was a lot of reticence to talk about adaptation. People thought, you know, if we talk too much about adaptation in the future, it would prevent people from really investing heavily in mitigation today. And so there sometimes is this tension between the two. People think of them as sort of substitutes, like we don't need to mitigate if we really believe we're going to adapt really effectively in the future. But I think most people who are very serious in the field, you know, understand we got to invest in both. You know, sort of failing to do any kind of mitigation is going to be absurdly costly for society. On the other hand, there's a fair amount of climate change that's already baked in based on the actions we've taken over the last many decades. And so we're going to have to adapt to them. And so, you know, I think now most people think of adopting a portfolio of strategies that sort of help us, you know, slow the car down, but also prepare us for the possibility of different types of impacts.
All right. So let's roll through that portfolio here, right? And especially the ones that are more forward looking and how we might go about adaptation. Is there a thread or two or a theme that comes to your mind as you start thinking about this stuff?
So I think it's helpful to think about adaptation using, you know, a little bit of a framework. So there's ways in which we adapt that are simply behavioral adjustments, right? Like if it gets, you know, hotter in the middle of the day, I might stop jogging around noon and might start waking up real early to jog before work when it's cooler. That's just, you know, a behavioral change, and there's certainly a cost to it, but in many ways it seems like it's a, you know, much cheaper change. Then there's other types of changes that we call defensive investments. Those are things like building infrastructure or installing air conditioners, you know, assembling seawalls, you know, large scale changes where we're actually building and doing things, making things that we wouldn't otherwise make if we weren't facing climate change. But then there's also other types of adaptation I think people don't always think about as adaptation. So for example, there's predatory actions that people take. So for example, a lot of my work is focused actually on conflict and violence as a result of climate change. And we sometimes think, for example, when people are having large-scale crop failures, for example, they might turn to other sources of revenue to help support their family, which sometimes might involve trying to capture resources from someone nearby. And so not all forms of adaptation are strictly good in the sense that a lot of times they impose harm on the people around you. And then the fourth kind of adaptation, which is maybe the simplest to think about, is just people picking up and leaving, right? Just like large-scale migrations. Those are the types of things we've seen actually a lot of in the past. You think about the Dust Bowl in the United States. You had, you know, a lot of people picking up and just moving to the cities, which got increasingly crowded. So, you know, that's a different type of adaptation, which is, you know, so that portfolio, those four types of actions, I think, are a nice way to break things down.
I know there's a lot of money involved here, right, in terms of required investment and potentially opportunity. What does the economic slice of this look like?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to highlight, and that's where a lot of research you know, is focused on today. It's sort of in the academic sphere. As you said, there's the direct costs that society might expend, for example, to build a seawall, right? You can imagine cities might have to raise a lot of funds to build a seawall that they weren't planning to build otherwise. And those types of large infrastructure investments can get quite costly. But I think what we're also realizing now is the second issue that you highlighted, these opportunity costs can be, you know, quite big. So, for example, if I'm going to spend money on building some piece of infrastructure or, you know, putting greenhouses over agricultural lands, that's money I could have done something else with, something probably more productive. But I have to sort of redirect those funds to invest in just protecting the stuff I have. And so, you know, it's you end up distorting people's investment decisions. Because essentially, like one way to think about it is it's like the operation and maintenance costs of all the things you've already decided to do that the current economy is already doing, those have just gone up because you now have to pay more to just protect the things you're already doing. So you're playing more defense, and that leaves you with fewer resources to move forward and innovate and sort of do the things that we really get more excited about.
That's totally interesting. I hadn't actually thought of that. So I was in the car on the way home yesterday, and I was listening to my local public radio station, as one does, and they had a spot for the new New Yorker Radio Hour, and it was David What's-His-Face from The New Yorker talking to Bill McKibben, noted climate activist. And McKibben, the quote they used from McKibben was, you know, 10 years ago, we were still only able to warn in vague terms about the consequences of a warming planet. Now, in the last year, even, we have been able to become much more specific about those warnings. Do you think, and I get this is a little off topic, but do you think specificity aids in the understanding of the need to adapt?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, to be clear, there are places in the world that will be net beneficiaries of climate change. And that's something that is often well, not explicitly talked about.
You know what's interesting is you talk about it and then people yell at you. And granted, he was indelicate about it. But Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, went to Finland a week ago and said, hey, look, there's money to be made when the climate changes. And everybody went, oh, my God. I mean, it's true. Right. But he was sort of blunt about it.
Yeah, I think we're at a stage where we have to make really thoughtful, balanced, objective decisions about what to do going forward. And it is very clear that there are winners and losers. There's cost and benefits. Even within a given location, there are industries that might benefit and industries that might be harmed. And so we need to sort of really recognize all of that. You know, if we pretend that things are only going to be catastrophic everywhere all the time, mm-hmm. First of all, it's not true. And second of all, that's not going to lead us to make good decisions. I think, you know, my job, right? I study climate change all the time, but I think about it as an investment problem for society. If we throw all of our money at climate change today because we are just totally panicked about it, then we're going to be taking money away from other investments that are also important. So, for example, we got to keep the schools open, right? Here in Oakland, we're having problems because we're not investing in the schools. We need to maintain the roads and have the fire departments grow. So there's all sorts of things we need to do with our resources. And climate change mitigation and climate change adaptation are part of that whole portfolio. But we need to think about it as one of those things within a larger portfolio. We can't just pretend sort of everything's on fire all the time because that's going to lead us to overinvest. You know, Bill Nordhaus, I think, made this point very clearly. You know, that's why he won the Nobel Prize, is to say sort of there's a balance in how we think about investing in fighting climate change. It's not that we ignore the problem, but we have to be even-handed about it.
Well, on that note, the even-handedness and equality kind of question, you know, a lot of the places that are facing the most immediate risk of climate change, the places that are not benefiting are places that are not particularly wealthy, small island countries or the Mekong and Ganges River deltas, right? How do we ensure, and will we be able to ensure, that the eventual investment is distributed a little bit evenly, especially considering that rich countries kind of, you know, caused all the damage and then are in the position to be able to spend their way out of it on some level?
Absolutely. You have nailed on the head what is one of the biggest issues and one of my own biggest concerns about the problem. From everything we understand about the problem, a lot of the places in the world that are the poorest and where people have some of the most challenging lives already, those are the places that are going to be most heavily impacted, sometimes because they're near sea level, sometimes because they're already much hotter and already drier with more erratic weather. So you're going to make life much more difficult for those populations. And then places further north that are more temperate, sometimes they might benefit. And so a lot of our research indicates that a sort of central impact of climate change on the world is that it will very likely widen global income inequality, and it will even widen income inequality within a country like the United States. You know, the U.S. South is already incredibly hot. There's many places where a lot of resources are already dedicated to just dealing with the climate. And those are also places that have had trouble with economic growth over the last several decades. And so sort of climate change acts to sort of reallocate wealth between people without them necessarily realizing it, because it's taking opportunity away from some of the poorer regions of the world and pushing it towards the wealthier regions. And that's the thing that really sort of scares me, because as we go down that road, it's very hard to imagine sort of how we get back to a place we want to be.
Is there to Molly's special this week and the coverage that Marketplace Tech is going to be doing over the next however long they decide to do this, is technology going to help us? I mean, are there tools that we have now that we didn't have 10 years ago that's going to help us adapt?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think technology is going to be central to coping with the challenges ahead. You know, in some cases, we're going to be using older technologies, but just getting more people access to them. So, for example, we know how to irrigate pretty well. Making sure that everybody who needs irrigation has access to it is just a question of scaling up things we know how to do. In other cases, you know, information technology, the fact that people around the world now have access to cell phones makes it so much easier to get them weather forecasts. You know, what we just saw in India recently, sort of, there was this massive cyclone that came through. And, you know, by some estimates, tens of thousands of people's lives were saved because they were able to be informed that they needed to evacuate. And it was done so much more efficiently than it's been done in the past. And so these types of innovations are going to be really central to reducing the impact on people. There's other, you know, there's new technologies too that people talk about. I think, Molly, you were sort of maybe alluding to these sort of discussions about geoengineering that are on the table. People are thinking about sort of big technologies that have never been deployed before in an effort to sort of protect larger and larger groups of people.
Some of the technology question, you know, even when you get to geoengineering, gets a like the tech gets a little crazy, right? And we talked to an investor who said, like, the ideas do. And look, I'm a sci-fi reader, right? So I'm totally like, oh, yeah, we'll invent this diamond coating and we'll put it on the bottom of buildings and it'll keep the water out when Manhattan floods. And but I know that there are investors who are looking at that possible future too, who are saying, look, there are technologies that we don't know how to build yet. There might be seawall technology that is more absorbent, but we don't have those materials yet. And I wonder, just to take us in a sci-fi direction, because I can't help it. You know, what is that opportunity start to look like? There are people who are saying, like Mike Pompeo, but other investors, there's potentially a new economy in here somewhere.
There's an element to that where it starts feeling like sci-fi and you're sort of, you know, trying to figure out how do I think about this in a reasonable way. I think, you know, if you were sitting in 1900 trying to imagine what was coming ahead, you know, something like Facebook would definitely feel like sci-fi, right? So when you start thinking about these long timescales, there's, you know, we just have to be open to having some imagination with what technology can do. But that's very different than relying on the idea that we can definitely deliver it. There's some technological problems that are just fundamentally hard to solve and that we might spend decades and decades banging our head against the wall and just be unable to solve them. And so, I think it's important that we think of, you know, things like mitigation as a hedge against the fact that we might not deliver some of these innovations. Now, that said, some of the geoengineering stuff, you know, we think it's definitely possible. Solar radiation management is, I think, probably one of the most popular ideas that people put out there. It's this idea that we can sort of emulate things that the volcanoes have done in the past. Like when Mount Pinatubo erupted, it sprayed dust up into the atmosphere and that reflected sunlight, cooled the planet down a few degrees. And people are talking about whether we can do that intentionally. And it's a super interesting question scientifically, because there's, you know, a lot of physics involved and thinking about sort of, you know, how effectively can we actually cool things down intentionally is tricky.
But can't you see some calculation being off by like a decimal point? And then the same thing happens to the whole planet happened to that Mars lander where they did metric instead of imperial measurements. And humanity, as we know, it goes away because somebody punched the wrong button on his calculator.
It's complicated.
Absolutely. And so I think what is now coming, so this has been done, like these calculations have been mostly contained in computer simulations, and folks have sort of written these abstract papers about what might happen. I think what's happening now is people are realizing, okay, this is starting to get real. Like people are starting to feel these impacts. And so the pressure is mounting to do this kind of research. But there's actually a lot of ethical questions about how do you do this research for exactly the reasons you say, like we're talking about messing with really big systems. Now we've been messing with it historically, unintentionally.
Right.
Now we're going to do it intentionally. And so the question is, how do you do it? So some of our research, for example, is like thinking about what might be unintended consequences of these things. And so, you know, we study if you reflect sunlight back to space, it actually means all the crops around the world don't grow as well. And so that has some unintended impacts on, you know, global food production. That seems to matter. So, you know, making these kinds of points are starting to come surface in the, you know, sort of research community. And I think as things get increasingly real, more and more people are going to start saying, like, okay, there are going to be costs, there are going to be benefits. Let's make a careful decision here.
This episode of Make Me Smart brought to you by What Could Possibly Go Wrong.
As soon as I hear Kai start to go, but, then I know the disaster scenario is
literally
incoming.
We messed up metric to Imperial and a shuttle crashed into Mars. Come on.
But a quantum computer would never make that mistake, right, Solomon?
No, of course not. Oh, my God.
No, I think we need to be cautious all the way around.
there you go.
I think that's the whole narrative here. I think we've learned a lot in the past. And I think it's amazing. It's one thing, you know, when you step back and you look at the situation we're in, it's amazing. This is the first time in human history that we've had the technology to think many decades into the future and sort of map out and make decisions about how we want to plan, how we want to sort of foster technology. Do we want to go down these different roads? We've never been able to have those conversations before. We never understood the economy this well. We never understood the physical world this well. Mm-hmm. This is a revolution in sort of how we as a society make decisions. And that's really exciting, but it's also, it starts making you sort of anxious when you look down the different roads and realize that, you know, we have to make these kinds of decisions together.
Solomon Tsiang, professor of public policy at Berkeley and on leave at Stanford as a visiting scholar in the Center on Global Poverty and Development. Solomon, thank you. You legitimately made us smart.
Thanks a lot. That was great. That was really good.
Yep.
Thanks a lot.
Minus the whole
take care.
You know, messing with the planet thing. But, you know.
Let it go.
All right. All right, I'm going to let it go. We're out of here.
There it is. There's the sigh.
Seriously, honestly, thank God there are people thinking about this stuff, right? In a considered and thoughtful way, because how do they get out of bed in the morning? You know what I mean?
Yep. Right? No, it's remarkable. Yeah. It is really remarkable. I mean, of all of the interesting things in there, you know, in that conversation with Solomon, one is just that the idea that there are people who are thinking about our survival as a species in this really specific manner. Like, what's it going to look like? What are the decisions we can make? How do we calculate the kind of global domino effect?
Right.
How do we
right.
geoengineer without breaking the Earth? Like, it's pretty... it's sci-fi, but it's so fascinating. It's so fascinating.
All right, so look.
Anyway, that was awesome.
No, it was good. It was great. Yeah. So look, weigh in here. First of all, what are you mm-hmm. doing to adapt and or mitigate? Hopefully you're doing a little bit of both. Let us know. It's, what is it? Yes, it's right there, Kai. Read it. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Send us a voice memo. Works better that way. Molly and I don't have to do as much reading. You know, Molly can do it. I can't. I can't read. All right, anyway.
No, we're very lazy. We're very lazy. Also, if you have heard about cool technologies, looking for them over on Marketplace Tech. Because, yes, turns out we're going to be covering this, you know, I don't know, indefinitely.
Forever.
So send those to us, too.
Yep.
It is time for a short break. And when we come back, our fixations.
Okay.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. The shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, we're back. We are here with what is on our minds. Molly's actually got one. Only one this week. Holy cow, look at that.
Well, it's funny because sharp viewers of this document will notice that, like, early this morning I put in a whole different thing.
You are outing yourself.
And then I got distracted. And, like, I almost kind of have two things in a way. Well, because I was obsessed with the Uber IPO, and I was like, the only problem with covering climate adaptation all week long is that I haven't gotten to weigh in at all on the Uber IPO.
It's your show. You can do what you want. Take 40 seconds at the end.
But I'm really into this.
All right, go ahead.
But then, well, okay, my thoughts on the Uber IPO are basically this. If you are a company, I know this isn't the link I have in here.
I just teed that one up, folks. You see how that worked?
This is also half my show, right?
Yeah, totally, so absolutely, 1,000%. You go, absolutely.
There's this whole narrative now about blaming the banks for, like, the Uber IPO flop, and the underwriters could have done more to prop it up, and then the pricing was all wrong, and the this and that. The company loses $1 billion a quarter.
Right. Next question? Yeah.
Next question is basically all I have to say about that.
Right.
And then I got super distracted by Disney buying the full operational control of Hulu. In 5 years, it'll buy out Comcast. So Disney now is going to launch its own Disney Plus streaming service. It's got Hulu. Probably it's going to put all the FX stuff on Hulu, which is going to be awesome because literally my favorite show is any crappy movie playing on FX at 9:22 when my child goes to sleep. And Disney is like the behemoth, you know, in the whole joke about like the five companies that run the world. Disney is like the behemoth that you sort of saw coming, but you didn't know the level of Godzilla that we are talking about here.
And
Comcast just crapped the bed on streaming. Had every
opportunity. That was literally a spit take. That was me literally doing a spit take. Wow.
I apologize for the inappropriate language, had every opportunity to not biff that this hard.
Yeah. And they did.
Yet they did.
Yeah.
The end.
And soon Disney will control all content.
Disney is gonna take all my money too. Yeah, I mean, like, it's not even I got Comcast out of my life. Like, I cut the cord. I have a local ISP. I have all of that. I'm not giving Comcast any money, but I can see already that Disney is gonna take all my money. Yep. As a consumer, I'm just gonna be like, okay, Disney and Verizon, fine. Okay.
For sure.
The two, you know.
For sure.
Y'all are worried about Facebook.
Yeah. Well, so I was actually going to throw a Facebook question in there, but now I'm not going to.
Ooh, do it.
Well, no. So here's the deal, and I don't know the answer to this, but how many viewers of its content does Disney have versus how many users of its service does Facebook have? And which one is ginormouser and which one is a greater threat, I'm exaggerating here, to humanity? You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably still. But look, yeah, mostly because it's more easily manipulatable, right? But still, I think it's really interesting that these two big, ginormous companies speak directly to a large fraction of humanity on the planet.
That's really true. You know, and before we talked about propaganda on Facebook, we talked about entertainment and advertising and the messages that come in there and what they do about women and people of color. Yeah. So, yeah, fair point.
There you go.
Disney and Facebook, basically Godzilla versus Mothra.
What's Mothra? What?
Oh, we are going to get so many emails now.
Okay, let's not. Let's
I'm going to leave it at
let's,
that, we're just but I can't wait.
Rewind. Anyway, so yeah, I know they're coming. All right, look, I just want to do one very quick observation about trade. I know we talked about it a little bit up at the top and how we're not going to talk about it, but I got to talk about it just a hair, and that is because of this. Yes, it's nice that the stock market has recovered on this Tuesday, the 14th of May, but part of the reason that we're not getting a fix to the China trade negotiations is because the stock market keeps on coming back. And yes, we all want our 401ks to be higher, and no, we don't want retirement funds to go down, but part of the reason that nobody's really taking this seriously in the White House is because the president looks at the stock market, and when the stock market stays up or rebounds, when he says things like he said today, oh, it's just a little squabble, and traders go, oh, well, fine, everything's great, and the stock rebounds, that's not helpful for negotiations. That's it. That's all I'm going to say. And we've got a couple of links. I mean, there's a piece in Bloomberg today. Neil Irwin, friend of the pod, who we had on last week, wrote a piece a couple of days ago saying basically the same thing. And I just think that's interesting. Live by the stock market, die by the stock market. That's the name of that game.
That's true. Okay.
Yeah.
Or like, or just sort of die in the background while you're focused on the stock market.
Well, you could do that. You could do that.
Is that sort of what you're saying here?
Yeah. But look, I mean, the S&P 500 is up 1.4% at this moment after the president came out this morning and said, hey, it's just a little squabble. No big deal. We're doing fine. And traders went, all right. Okay. Okay, good. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good. We can do that.
Yeah. I feel like this is less a story about economics and more a story about credulity.
Yes. 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 Which we have talked about before on this podcast.
We have.
We have. Mm-hmm. All right.
That seems like a safe time to turn to your thoughts. Yes.
Let us turn.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
So look, I was just talking about Neil Irwin, and here he is again. So we talked to Neil last week about some of the things the Federal Reserve is trying to deal with in this economy right now, low interest rates and low inflation and growing jobs, and how that is sort of a conundrum for the central bank and what happens if the economy goes south, as it eventually will, because there is going to be another recession. Anyway, got a couple of follow-up questions on this one. First of all, from Allison Vermeulen. She works here. She is our colleague. She sits just down the hall from us here in the studio. And she wanted to know about the actual effect of interest rates on people in this economy.
Is that house mortgages? Is that taxes that we pay on products? Like, what is the interest rate percentage affecting on our day-to-day lives?
So it's not taxes, right? Taxes are this thing called fiscal policy, which is how the government raises and spends its money, and it raises money through taxation. But interest rates do affect home mortgages, car loans. That's what's called monetary policy. And it absolutely trickles down. When the Federal Reserve raises rates, your car loan will become more expensive. So yes, all that stuff Neil said about, if you are feeling credit cards getting more expensive or your home mortgage is going up, the Federal Reserve gets some blame for that. So that is totally what's happening.
You know, it's so funny. We never talk about saving. I think I've brought this up before.
Americans don't really do it well, you know?
Right. And I can't say that I'm like the world's most awesome saver, but enough that I obsess about the fact that you used to actually make money when you put your money
right.
in a bank account.
So,
You used to get an interest payment, you'd make 4%.
So, right.
ING came along and was like, 4% on your savings. And I was like, hot damn, that's legit.
Right. So here's what's happened, right? In the 10 years, going on 11 years now since the financial crisis, we have seen incredibly low interest rates in what's called the fixed income part of this economy. That is to say, certificates of deposit and checking accounts and savings accounts, those are incredibly low. And so they're not paying a lot. So if you're on a fixed income and you don't have a lot of disposable income and you're putting money away like my mom in a certificate of deposit, she's getting like a percent, less than a percent. So what have people done instead? People have gone to the stock market where returns have been really, really nice over the past 10 years. The catch, of course, is that money in the stock market is at risk. You know, you can put a CD and, you know, you're only going to get 1%, but you're not going to lose any of that money. If you put it in stocks and you get more money, you get 3% gains, then you could and will eventually, if you hold it long enough, you'll probably lose at some point. So it's one of the things that's happened because of the way that interest rates have been going in this economy the past decade.
Yeah, God, it's totally fascinating. The metaphorical gravity of the stock market and how everything flows that way and everything. Our producer, Eve Char, likes to say that it's the financialization of everything.
Yeah. For sure.
Like it all. Yeah. Anyway, our next question turns out is also about saving on some level and interest rates. In a recession, obviously, you can only cut interest rates so much, you think, until you get to negative interest rates, which Kai said most people find baffling. There's been some experimentation with this in Japan, I think. But listener Marlon Cox had this question about it.
What's so bad about a negative interest rate?
So negative interest rates, generally speaking, right? So basically what happens is that during a period of negative interest rates, a bank would figuratively, or you would pay the bank money to hold your money, right? The catch, of course, is that combines with a thing called deflation. And when deflation happens in an economy, prices steadily fall. And that is a bad thing because instead of going out and spending $200 on a new television and that's just driving the economy in terms of demand, right, and, you know, making manufacturers build more television sets, what happens is you sit there and you say, well, shoot, why should I spend $200? Because in a week, it's going to be 180, so I can spend 180. And then, of course, in a week, you say, oh, man, it could be 160, so I'm just going to wait. And consumers actually stop buying things, and then demand in this economy dries up. And that is actually an even bigger problem, because as I think we've said on this podcast a couple of times, consumers and spending on behalf of consumers is something like 3/4 of all economic activity in the United States. So when consumers see deflation happening and negative interest rates and all of that stuff, they just kind of sit tight. And that's not a good thing. That is not a good thing. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Last week, I talked about aliens as part of my news fix, as one does. And I mentioned the Fermi paradox, which people got very excited about. The Fermi paradox basically says, by the way, given the size and age of the universe, mathematically speaking, aliens should have already made contact with us on Earth, but have not. That's the paradox part.
How do we
one listener who goes by Charlie Foxtrot, I don't know if it's a real name, but maybe.
That's fine.
Said, wanted to keep this thread going and tweeted at us and said, do you have a favorite solution to the paradox? He said, I'm a rare earth guy myself and or we're doomed. Rare earth means that he thinks, in fact, the conditions for life to form are so exceedingly rare that we probably are the only ones. I will say that readers of my obsession, the Three Body Problem trilogy, you might need to make another crack at it. Like, it is just, it explains all the things. Anyway, I'm afraid I'm going to give it away, but there's like a dark forest idea too, that the universe is so dangerous, like that a life-filled universe is so dangerous that basically it's in everyone's best interest to just shut their mouths and not get found.
So maybe they're already here, but Men in Black is real.
There's that. That is a theory also.
I like that.
That
one
like
too.
We're either rare or we're kind of screwed because like it's been kept secret, or that they're keeping it secret. Like that a more advanced civilization's dropped a little hood around us. I mean, you can really have fun with the Fermi paradox if you are a giant nerd such as one of us.
Should one of us happen to be. I'm not saying which one in this conversation. So moving on. Shall we move on? Make me smart
on.
Question time.
Yes,
what
please.
Is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? Here's a listener from the Bay Area.
Hi, Molly and Kai. This is Fraheen from the South Bay. I thought that most people, especially in the diverse Bay Area, understood Ramadan. But I realized after posting a status about it on Facebook that many folks don't. So, while I'm no scholar, I would like to help folks become a little smarter about the month of Ramadan. Ramadan is the 9th month in the Islamic calendar, which follows the lunar cycle. This means that Ramadan moves up about 10 days every year. We fast from dawn to dusk, so about 15 hours from 4:45 a.m. to 8 p.m. Suhoor is the pre-dawn meal many Muslims eat, while iftar is the sunset meal. The month of Ramadan is about spirituality. By giving up the worldly pleasure of eating and drinking, we can't drink water either. The idea is to become closer to God.
I think that was awesome. I'm so glad we had it. I will also say,
agree.
If were I to be a Muslim, I would be praying, and I use this not facetiously at all, for wintertime Ramadans. Because a summertime Ramadan, can you imagine? Like 4:30 in the morning to 8 at night, right? But wintertime, 7:15 to, 4:30. I just,
are a practical man, Rizdal.
Well, and I'm not spiritual in any real ways. But I'm really glad we had that on.
You'd be loving
cool.
that.
Yeah.
That was wonderful. Yes. Thank you. Thanks for Heen. And thanks, producers, for including it. Ramadan, by the way, did begin on May 5th and ends this year on June 3rd at sundown. So it's happening right now. And then we have a link to a pretty cool explainer about it also on our website, makemesmart.org. And please keep sending us answers like this. They're amazing.
Cool.
And they make us smarter. makemesmart@marketplace.org. Record it. Again, the question is, what's something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about?
I was having a conversation with Daniel Ramirez the other day. Was it Daniel?
Yeah.
I don't even remember. About lyrics to this song. We were talking about the new Morning Edition theme music and how it turns out there are lyrics to the Morning Edition theme. And we were talking about lyrics to this song. Yeah, there are.
Huh.
And listeners may weigh in on the new Morning Edition theme music, should they so choose. But yeah, there are words. There are lyrics. Anyway, Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Ben Talladay, Daniel Ramirez, composers.
Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore.
Ben didn't do anything this week. I'm just saying. Ben didn't do anything this week.
He's not even here.
Yeah.
The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I did all the work on my video production, which is why it looks so, which is why my forehead looks so shiny as usual. Somebody should totally write us some lyrics. And
somebody
you know
will.
They will.
You know it's coming.
They
you
definitely coming. Will. And that's yeah, the best part sure. about podcasting, yep. basically. Anyway, Mothra versus Godzilla.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.